Blog Talk Radio.
This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone.
Everybody, welcome back to the Jewelcast. It is September 25th, 2017, and we are back for what we're calling the season premiere for season four. It actually hasn't been that long since our last episode, but now that we have preseason hockey and some of our questions are answered, and we've invited four people onto the show for some reason, we're going to go in and call this our big season premiere blowout. So, on the Jewelcast today, we will be answering questions such as, how was the China trip, and who's going to play defense for the Kings, and was it a good idea for me to eat all this pad thai in 10 minutes before the podcast? We'll find out soon enough. So for starters, I think we have two of our three guests on, and we'll be grouping in the third at some point. So for starters, let's go ahead and welcome James and Sarah. So Sarah, you know as Sarah A on Jewels from the Crown. And James, you know as Simba1019 on Jewels from the Crown. So, Sarah and James, welcome aboard.
Hello, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I think this would be my debut to the podcast world, so it's an honor.
I believe it is your podcast debut, which is very exciting. I know we had Sarah on fairly recently. I know we had Robin on one of the last two or three episodes. Robin will be joining us, I presume, in the next few minutes. But for now, we'll go ahead and get started because we have a lot to talk about. On the last episode, we did preview some of the season. We talked a little bit about what was going to happen with new acquisitions like Mike Camilleri. We hypothesized how John Stevens' arrival was going to change the Kings. And we are going to be able to talk a little bit more about that now that we've actually seen some games. So before we launch into it, I think we just got Robin on the phone. So, Robin, are you there?
I'm here. You know, technical difficulties with Blog Talk Radio.
You're good. My long-winded intro is now over, so we are ready to go.
Awesome.
So let's go ahead and launch right into it. So we're going to start with, of course, the China trip. Now that the team is back, we got to see two games against the Vancouver Canucks. Any result other than a victory over the Canucks would have been disappointing, but fortunately we managed to grab a couple wins and zero official points. I know that for the first game, Sarah, you wrote about it for the site, so we'll go ahead and let you start. What were your general observations about the game before we get to the whole China experience?
I think one of the big things that I noticed was, and it's something that they had talked about all summer with John Stevens coming in, is that, you know, the style of play isn't going to change too much, but it's still going to change. And one of the big things was, you know, in puck movement and especially on the power play, it at times looked like a completely different team than the one we've watched the past couple of years. So getting to see, you know, players come in with renewed energy and actually, you know, maybe forsaking some possession and some shots on goal, but in favor of actually moving the puck around and not just passing to each other and then missing the net. It just seemed like a whole different energy and a different vibe than what we had been seeing, especially the last half of last season, once it became kind of clear that things were not going to be going well.
Definitely. And I think it was a good opportunity because not every fan of every team this preseason is going to get to see the full squad as early as we did. mostly because the NHL wanted the Kings and the Canucks to, you know, have some representative NHL teams who actually looked like NHL teams. Although with Vancouver, you know, you're kind of taking your chances. So that was a game one. Robin, I know you got to see game two. After watching the Anaheim game, I made it almost halfway through game two. So hopefully you have a little more insight as to what happened. So what'd you think?
Okay, game two seemed kind of like early on, kind of like Sarah was saying, they definitely had a lot of renewed energy. But I did notice on the power play, they were starting to slip back into some old habits, especially I think it was on their first power play. Somebody drew a holding call, and they just kind of didn't really muster much. I mean, I guess you can give credit to Vancouver's penalty kill, but it just kind of seemed like some of the bad old habits were creeping back in. But otherwise, I would agree with Sarah's assessment that they kind of looked like they had a lot of renewed energy. But it's kind of hard to tell because they didn't have quite their full lineup. There was no Kopitar, Doughty sat out, and Quick was also out. So.
Right, and I believe Mike Camilleri as well, which meant we were robbed of more Camilleri-Kopitar observations, but we'll have plenty of time to observe that, apparently. I guess real quick on that note, James, I think you wrote about Mike Camilleri and his potential combination with Andrei Kopitar. Any thoughts on them staying together? I know that there was a little bit of shuffling in the preseason with, I think, Tyler Toffoli got some shifts with Kopitar. Do you think it's something that's going to work out well for the Kings?
Well, before I answer that, I just want to say for the record, the Los Angeles Kings are the only NHL team that are undefeated in China. So something to celebrate there.
Cheers.
Well, Camilleri, you know, he's an old name. You know, he's a nostalgic name. The LA Times called it the nostalgia line. They were a force, Camilleri, Brown, and Kopitar, back in 07-08. Back when Brown scored 33 goals in a season, which is amazing. Didn't know that was possible. But Camilleri was derailed by a rib injury back then, and the consensus was that he was already starting to decline, whereas Kopitar and Brown would be the next young stars of the team. And hence the arbitration with Lombardi didn't go well, and that's why the trade to Calgary happened, and we haven't seen him for a long time until now. Unfortunately, I can't be so optimistic because since then he has missed 150 games to injury since 2005. Last year he was a healthy scratch for the first time in his career and only scored 10 goals and 21 assists. So the idea that the 35-year-old Camilleri can somehow, you know, rejuvenate this offense all by himself is quite a stretch, and it is quite telling that the biggest free agent move that the Kings made this past season, off season, was to sign Camilleri. They were unable to have much room to do too much else.
Sure, and Camilleri, I mean, I don't know if we're going to see explosiveness. I know we're going to see shots with him down on one knee, but it's going to be interesting to see how that, some are calling it first line, some are calling it second or nostalgia line, which I actually kind of like. But I think it's going to center more on what Kopitar does. Robin, I guess we'll go to you. Did you like Kopitar's game in that first game against Vancouver or in any of the preseason action you've gotten to observe so far?
Being up in San Francisco, I don't really have much access to see the Kings. Shout out to Reddit for their help on China games. Legality questionable, but you know, in any case, I haven't really experienced Kopitar, but you know, if you want to talk about Anaheim, I did half pay attention to that while the Dodgers were clinching against the Giants.
Sure. I think we'll get to that in a moment, but I guess we'll go to Sarah instead. I forgot. Sorry. I'm losing track of who saw what. But yeah, Sarah, what did you think then of Kopitar's game across the world?
In the first China game that he played in, like, I thought he looked fantastic. I thought he had a lot of energy. He was going to the net a lot more than I feel like we've maybe seen him do recently. You know, kind of back to the same old Kopitar that we're used to of, you know, being hard to get off the puck and, you know, just being someone that you don't want to have to go up against. So if that's what the long off season has done for him, to fully, you know, rehab any injuries or anything that were lingering and to kind of bring him back into the season with, you know, that kind of fire that people were afraid that, you know, there were so many people being like, the captaincy has made him soft and given him, like, you had a perfectly good human and you gave him an anxiety, like, you know, a lot of people wondering about what he had turned into after being given the captaincy, like, you know, maybe he needed time to adjust or whatever, but plus whatever injuries he was dealing with. But if he has been able to move on from all that and is back to the, you know, same Selke winning player that we all know and love, like, it could be a very good year for him again.
Yeah, and Kopitar was obviously really, really heavily criticized for last season. I think 10 goals and 42 assists was the final output, and we talked about it in many different pieces on Jewels from the Crown about whether his shooting percentage was down, whether it was lingering injury or the trips to help Slovenia qualify for an Olympics that he won't get to play in. But it's Carter was the captain in game two with Kopitar out. And there's always been a sense that, you know, Jeff Carter was, I guess, coming for the throne, especially last year that he took the scoring title on the Kings for the first time away from Kopitar since 2007, I believe. So I guess, James, we'll go to you next. What do you think Kopitar is the most important player for the Kings this season, or is that sort of just a narrative because of his struggles last year?
Well, before I get to that, it's a little too early to, you know, be making too many conclusions. You know, many of the goals that were scored in these China games and with Anaheim were the result of botched defense. You know, in the regular season, you're not going to see a team allow Tanner Pearson two breakaways. You're not going to see a team allow Tyler Toffoli to stand right in front of the net unguarded. The Kings are not going to let Chris Tanev, you know, streak past the blue line at full speed to score a goal. So a lot of these are botched defense is what's causing so many goals. So we don't want to get too excited. But at the same time, it's nice to see that the Kings are still capable of putting the puck in the net. I mean, we were doubting whether they can even do that last season, and looks like they got that monkey off their back. Now, as far as whether Kopitar is the most important player, I think I'm gonna go out on a limb and I'm gonna say that the barometer for the near term success is not so much Kopitar, but it's actually Toffoli and Pearson. We know that it's pretty axiomatic. We know that Carter's gonna continue to produce. We can't say with confidence that the other parts of the Cup core are gonna produce. They are getting older. Gavrik, we can't count on. So the near-term bellwether is going to be Toffoli and Pearson. So if they continue to score at the high rates that the Kings are hoping they would score, then they have a great chance. But if they struggle, then there goes another source of offense for a team that's already strapped for offense. A lot of the Kings' success this year is going to be based on, you know, whether the 70s line continues to stay hot. And I think they are a proven product, and I think John Stevens would be wise to continue to play that card, roll those dice.
Yeah, and I think Toffoli got off the hook a little bit last year, partially because he was injured for 19 games, but also because Kopitar was so visibly failing to produce, especially putting pucks in the net, whereas Toffoli still managed to pick up I think 16 goals in 63 games. Robin, do you think that on Jeff Carter's wing is the right place for Toffoli and Pearson, at least to start the season?
Yeah, I mean, it's a familiar place. I know we all joke about Carter being Toffoli's dad, but at the same time, it's just kind of they read each other like they are family. So they have a good sense of where each other is on the ice. And especially given that Toffoli and Pearson, I like them together in particular because they've had a history of producing with a competent center back to their AHL days and when it was still AHL back in Manchester. Like Lyndon Vay, if you can remember him, not an NHLer, but now you give them a really good center like Jeff Carter, and I think that they can recreate much of their success.
Sure, and I think that most of the criticism that Kopitar caught last year, or at least in the last few years, especially before last year, because it was really the only gripe, was that Kopitar wasn't always necessarily producing, and the idea that Kopitar should be able to score no matter who is on his wings was sort of a running theme that, you know, when he had Milan Lucic, he was doing great, but when he was being put with Dwight King or Trevor Lewis, well, Kopitar should be making them better as opposed to the other way around. And I know last season there was the occasional effort. I remember Toffoli and Pearson being centered by Nick Dowd at one point, moving Pearson and Toffoli up and down the lineup a little bit to try and bring production out of others. And Nick Dowd actually was skating on the wing today, which is kind of interesting, potentially clearing a path for Nick Shore to be backed up by an Andrioff or by a Kempe if there's an idea to move him back to center. I guess as long as we're talking about the forwards, Sarah, any thoughts on the current alignment? It's a pretty static forward group, but if we're talking about Kempe or Brodzinski, who scored a really nice shootout winner in China, do you think that there's an advantage to moving either of those guys up into the top six?
You know, I think that, like, first off, every time I try to, like, put together my, like, if I were the coach, this is what my lineup would be, I get the first two lines done, and then I just throw up my hands because we have, like, 10 guys who can compete for the bottom six spots, and they're all basically interchangeable. So, like, I'm going to be very curious to see, like, who becomes extra forward, who gets sent down, what's going to happen. I know at one point in time I floated last year whenever it was clear that we weren't going to make the playoffs, and I was like, this is the time to just start playing with stuff, floated the idea of putting Pearson and Toffoli on the top line with Kopitar and then giving Jeff Carter a new set of children, basically, to babysit, and putting Kempe and Brodzinski on his wings, which I think, yes, right? Like, I think it could be, you know, two other, like, creative, speedy young players that, like, can play off of well, but they seem actually pretty committed to letting Kempe try his hand at being center, so that has dashed my hopes. But if I were making the lineup, I would, you know, try that, because it could spread out. It would give Kopitar better wingers. We know that, like, Jeff Carter can kind of produce with, like, you could put Andy Andrioff on his wing and he'll still make something happen. And, you know, kind of free up some more spots for, you know, whatever Jordan the Nolandrioff we want to put in the bottom six.
It's going to catch on. I just know it.
We're going to try real hard.
Yeah. So I guess then, James, do you have any strong takes on those bottom six forwards? Maybe like a Michael Mersch who's trying to make the team and avoid getting put on waivers? I know there's been a little bit of murmuring for whether Justin Auger is ready for his tryout with the Kings. Do you have any opinions to share?
Well, I'm with the others. Yeah, you go to the bottom six of the Kings, and it's you just throw your hands up. I agree with that. But I mean, we've already seen everything that Clifford and Lewis are going to show us. Unfortunately, at this stage, I don't think these older dogs have any new tricks. I would like to see Andrioff get a bigger role if we're going to pick among the Nolan Andrioff Clifford combination. I'd like to see Andrioff play a bigger role simply because he's younger, has more upside, and doesn't have the concussion history, which is a sad issue. I'm excited about Kempe and Brodzinski. They have skill. I was there for the Washington game last season. He scored his NHL debut. That was a skill stick handling move from the point. Beautiful goal. I'd like to see Amadio get a chance. I know we're going to talk about that later, but 50 OHL goals. Come on, you have to. You are entitled to a chance at the NHL if you score 50 OHL goals. So, I'd like to see some juggling. I'm excited about the first round pick. I know he's injured, hopefully he's young enough to recover quickly and fully, and then we'll have another resource we can put into lines 3 and 4.
Yeah, and I think we did post our top 25 article on Amadio or Amadio. I've heard both pronunciations in the last week or so. But there's been sort of a running joke that every prospect we've written about has the same NHL projection of about 20 to 25 points based on their junior stats or their AHL stats. But it is a little different when you look at a 20-year-old producing in the AHL as opposed to, you know, a 19-year-old producing in juniors. You'd expect an inflated point total, but he's been able to back it up with the rain. In terms of other rain prospects, I know that we'll get to the rest of the younger folks later on, but Robin, there's a few rain players who are going to either make the team or be exposed to waivers. Curtis McDermid on defense, Justin Auger up front, Michael Mersch up front as well. Of those three, do you think there's one that has a better shot or maybe a better chance to produce for the Kings?
So I like Mersch. Mersch has been a pretty consistent player with the Rain in the 3 years that he's been there. I never really understood why the Kings soured on him, because I think his NHL projection, his NHL E projection was somewhere around 35 points, I want to say. I'm not 100% sure. I mean, he's been pretty consistent in scoring close to, I think he's a half a point a game player in the AHL, which is pretty good, especially considering that he's NHL third line material. So if I'm going to pick, I would have to say under new management, hopefully Michael Mersch gets a chance, but I don't think he's really had much of a chance to shine in preseason so far.
Sure.
Other than that, I might say McDermott.
Yeah, and McDermott is interesting, too, just because he is sort of the, you get the idea that maybe the Kings are looking for their new Matt Green, and I think Christian Follin signing was a big part of that potential equation. He had the shoulder injury, too, last season. But we'll talk a little bit about the defensemen, because there's a few contenders for that seventh defenseman spot. So Follin is one of them. He's signing from the Wild, the biggest defensive free agent signing of 2017. And he's, you know, I've watched him so far this preseason. He, similar to maybe a McDermott, you're not going to be too impressed by him, I think, unless he fights like McDermott did, or he completely wrecks some people. And it's hard to really get a feel for a player like that off of a handful of games. The Minnesota Wild blog, Hockey Wilderness, was pretty high on him at least partway through the season before he struggled and then was injured. But he's got, you know, potential as a sixth defenseman to maybe impress, but you're not going to get too much of the offensive upside, it seems like, from him. And that's where you might look to a guy like Oscar Fantenberg, who's coming in from the KHL. And I know a few of you have opinions on Fantenberg, but we'll start with Sarah, just because I believe you wrote about him a few days ago. What can you tell us a little bit more about Fantenberg and maybe what his chances of making this team are?
So he is, Oscar Fantenberg is one of those signings that I feel like for most collective Kings fans just sort of ignored, because I don't necessarily think the team has had that strong of a track record of bringing guys over from Europe to start their NHL careers. I know there was a guy last year, Bjorkstrand, I think, who everyone thought maybe could have been a depth player, and he just got sent right to the AHL. They had no use for him. Fantenberg is 25. He is Swedish. He spent most of his career playing in the Swedish professional leagues, but was in the KHL last year, and kind of had a little bit of a breakout year there, both points-wise and just overall performance. Was tapped to be in the KHL All-Star game before he had to pull out with an injury. Has played internationally for Sweden all throughout his career. And is someone that I guess the Kings had had their eyes on for quite some time, and they finally felt like his game had progressed to be more of an all-around defenseman that they were ready to pull the trigger on signing him. They like a lot of his, you know, puck movement, his pace. Like, they think he's a good, you know, decision maker with passing and everything. And so he was a little bit of the surprise inclusion on the China roster, because everyone just sort of assumed that Kevin Gravel was going to be the lock because he played on the team for most of last year. And then he got left at home and Fantenberg came in. I felt like he was more noticeable in the first game than he was in the second game. Just, you know, maybe overshadowed by some other players, but kind of seems like one of those players who, if I'm not noticing him, maybe that's a good thing. You're a defenseman. You don't necessarily want to realize that they're there unless they're scoring a goal. I think he has more of a shot than any of us maybe thought at the start of the offseason or whenever they signed him, at either making the team as kind of a seventh defenseman, or if he does go to the AHL, being someone who gets called up, you know, fairly quickly if needed. He is waivers exempt, so he can be sent down without having to worry about losing him for anything. So if anything, that may hurt his chances at making the team, because they know that they can send him to Ontario without risking losing him to another team.
Yeah. So you mentioned Gravel. Gravel was, I was going to say a surprise exclusion, but maybe the surprise exclusion from that China roster, because they did take, I think, 8 or 9 defensemen to China and left off Gravel, who was with the team for the vast majority of last season. James, I believe you did his season review. Do you think there was more that Gravel could have done last year, knowing that he's waiver exempt this year, to maybe lock in a spot on the Kings?
Well, I mean, hindsight's always 20/20. There's always, I mean, we didn't make the playoffs, so I think there's a lot that all 30 of them could have done better. Kevin Gravel, I agree with you, Eric, that he had the most to lose and lost a little bit by being left out of the China roster. Oscar Fantenberg, here's a stat that I'll give you. 20 assists in 44 KHL games. You know me, I like normalizing. When you normalize that to an 82-game season, that's 37 assists. That's more than Doughty. Okay, that's more than Doughty. So that's something to think about for a 25-year-old KHL All-Star, high production. How can you not believe that there's so much more upside to this guy, and how can you not be excited about this? So I'm on the Fantenberg bandwagon. As far as Gravel, although he did have an assist against in the Anaheim game, he was also a -2. And, yeah, he didn't make enough of an impact. And one of the things that I wrote about Gravel to secure his spot on the roster is to take a page out of Forbert. Remember Forbert, when he came in 2 years ago, the knock on him was that he didn't show enough passion for the game. It's almost as if he wasn't sure he fully wanted to even be there, you know, and to impress your employer, if you want to impress your NHL employer, the best way to show that you want the job is to fight and scrap and stick up for your teammates. And that's what he started doing last year, is to really get in there, get down and dirty, stick up for his teammates, get physical. And one thing about Gravel's game is it's a little too clean. You know, I think Gravel can take a page out of Forbert and, you know, start to digging in there and getting down and dirty with his opponents.
Sure, and I think that's where a guy like Follin or a guy like McDermott wants to distinguish themselves. I think McDermott getting into a fight in that first preseason game was maybe the most predictable thing that happened all preseason, other than Brandon Prust getting into a fight. Although Prust was released from his PTO today, so whatever he did was not enough to make the Kings, of course. But I agree on Gravel's front. I thought the best defenseman against the Ducks was actually Alex Lintuniemi, who really has had a quiet couple years in the Kings system, especially for a second-round pick. But he made some actual, you know, I hesitate to say highlight reel defensive plays, but he did break up a two-on-one. He cleared some pucks out of the crease. He looked pretty composed. He looked sort of a little bit like Forbert did last year for the big club, where maybe he was getting caught having to take care of dangerous situations, and maybe he wasn't scoring. But overall, I wasn't thrown into a panic too much when I was watching him. So I guess we'll go around real quick, just assuming that we have locked into the blue line, Doughty, Muzzin, and Martinez, and Forbert, and Paul Ledoux, who I've been reading Kings season previews, and Ledoux seems to be missing from all of them, which feels like an oversight, especially when they're throwing in a guy like Gravel. But Robin, I'll start with you. Who would you want to be the sixth member of that hypothetical blue line?
Honestly, I really like Gravel. Like, I'm really big on Gravel because I followed his college career. And the thing I like about Gravel is that there's never any panic in his game. So he's very steady on the back end, and he's very calm and collected. And when he first got his call-up, like, that was a big thing with Gravel, and everybody raved about how calm he was. And I place a little bit, I mean, I think grit is a little bit overrated personally. I mean, you know, talking about Forbert fighting, I was like, okay, there are better things to do with our time than start a fight, but this is the Kings we're talking about. So my opinion is a little bit different than management's opinion, obviously. But anyway, short story, Gravel.
Sure. And I think, if I remember right, Gravel had 6 penalty minutes or something last year, which is, like you said, sort of the opposite of someone who's scrapping. It's nice to have someone clean on defense, but
that's,
you know,
pretty big,
it depends
too,
on priorities, I guess.
Especially when you have Doughty, who has a tendency to take penalties.
Yeah, yeah, and maybe that's, you know, tough competition, tough, you know, times of the game, but definitely. I guess then, James, who is your sixth defenseman on that blue line? Are you on the Fantenberg bandwagon, the Fant wagon?
Well,
sorry.
Yes, I am. Like I said, he has so much upside, and he is. You know, Gravel had an. Yes, okay. Granted, the Ducks game, we were pitting our B team against our kind of A minus B plus team of the Ducks. I mean, they had some pretty skilled players, Silverberg, Raquel, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But you know that. I mean, nevertheless, that is your opportunity to show that show your worth against you know, bigger competition. Don't tell me that, you know, as an NHLer, you can't handle the top competition every once in a while and at least hold serve every once in a while. So it's unfortunate it did kind of give him a few minus points there, and I can't ignore the statistics, and that's why I'm gonna go with Fantenberg. Gravel is also a waiver exempt, I believe, so it's a zero risk decision. Also with Ledoux, Yeah, that's a name we haven't been hearing this preseason. Ledoux, you know, he still has a lot of work. I know people are excited about his production and raw potential, and it seems like a fresh face on defense, you know, for the LA Kings. But he does have a very high minus rating. So in my opinion, if it's going to be between Gravel and Ledoux, Gravel is the safer choice because of what the others have described. He does have a level of poise to his game. He can handle the puck very calmly and can get it out of the defensive zone. So between Gravel and Ledoux, Ledoux still has a lot of work remaining.
Yeah, and with Ledoux, just to review the Ledoux, he did play 22 games last year. He had 8 assists, so he did produce pretty well, especially for someone making their NHL debut. I think 4 of those points were on the power play, so maybe he's not producing a bunch of even strength. I know that, as you mentioned, he was on the ice for quite a few goals against last year. He was paired with Jake Muzzin for a great deal of those after Daryl Sutter decided to get Muzzin away from Alec Martinez. He played a lot with Ledoux, and the two of them, for whatever reason, maybe it was the same thing that had been afflicting Muzzin all year, but goals just went in the net. And, you know, at that point, I think it was Quick and Bishop for most of that stretch. So it's easier for someone like Muzzin, who is able to avoid really being in trouble on his own end and giving up a bunch of goals until last season. There's a little more to go off of, but for Ledoux in his first 22 games, he did struggle with that. Sarah, any other thoughts on the defensive shuffle before we move on?
No, I think I'm kind of with James. Like, I would not mind seeing Oscar Fantenberg up there to start. I think that 6-7 defenseman position, you know, is something that, especially Fantenberg, Gravel, and I think Ledoux all being waivers exempt, like, if we need to play a little Ontario shuffle for a little while to really figure out who is the best person, I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, kind of rotating back and forth between those guys until someone really starts to shine. But I'd be interested in just letting Fantenberg loose and seeing how he adapts to the, you know, NHL.
Sure.
And
go ahead, James.
Yeah, if I may, I think we need to discuss the Muzzin-Martinez pairing. And I know a lot has been said about, you know, we need to break them up. I know I wrote, you know, after minus 21, should we trade Muzzin?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was analyzing, I was doing the work to write that, and I realized that the minus ratings, pretty much everyone on the Kings was suffering. Their minus plus minus rating went down considerably. Aside from the third and fourth offensive lines, the first line, second line, the defense, they all went down considerably. So after discovering that, I changed my mind. I realized maybe it's not so much a knock on Muzzin individually, but more of the product of the stale system. And I'm really hopeful for a bounce back, but at the same time, I'm open to a trade, but it needs to be the right one. And because a trade is always possible on the horizon, I do believe that the job openings will be there for the kids.
Yeah, I think I was probably going to go with Christian Follin as a guy who I'd like to see start on the sixth spot, just because he's a right shooting defenseman, and that's something that we need to consider when we're talking about Muzzin and Martinez too. Martinez, he's played so much on his off shooting hand, playing on the right side as a left shooter, that we don't really consider it anymore, and I don't think it's a problem necessarily. But if we talk about splitting up Martinez and Muzzin, then, you know, the de facto pairing there, if Forbert is staying on the left, is you have Forbert Martinez and you go back to like a Doughty Muzzin pairing. And it's, you know, it's appealing because Muzzin did so well with Doughty in the past. I think a lot of the consideration is, can Muzzin anchor his own pairing, or do you trust him to do that when you're talking about putting him with Martinez or having your 2A and 2B or 2 and 3 defensemen together and trusting Dowdy to take on responsibility with pretty much anyone. Let's talk about that Muzzin-Martinez pairing, because that was such a huge debate last year, and during the preseason it's sort of been glossed over because we're always concerned about the new people and new players. Robin, what's your take on Muzzin-Martinez? Do you want to see them start the year together again?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not really sure. I don't think it really made a big difference because their game, well, Martinez's game has evolved a lot, but I would like to see more of these, I'll call them shooty pairings. You know, these guys who are more inclined to be offensive-minded versus, you know, the traditional stay-at-home defense end a la Matt Green and take your pick of whoever else we've had come through the system.
Sure. Yeah.
So I'd be in favor of keeping them together.
Right on. Sarah, any other dissenting opinion perhaps, or are you of the mind that maybe it's not that much of a difference?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's that much of a difference. And I know that I've read some interviews with, I think, coaching staff talking about, you know, working with Jake Muzzin over the summer to kind of tweak his game a little bit and help him get, you know, just get back to the game that he started out playing with his team. And I'd want to give them a go at the start of the season just to see, you know, how much Jake has progressed to, like, getting the confidence back in his game and not, you know, being weighed down by the minus $2 million that he was last year. and then if it's not working, there's plenty of options to switch it up and see what they've got. But I'd say start out with it.
Sure. And we're talking about, of course, China Series MVP Jake Muzzin. So let's show him the respect he deserves.
He got a real
although,
trophy.
Yeah, it's you know, Muzzin got one Norris vote a couple years ago, so I think this is going to replace that as the biggest individual honor of his career. It was a fifth place Norris vote, though. I want to be clear.
Even in preseason, this connects never changed.
Yep. I'm just so proud of him. So let's before we do leave China behind, let's talk quickly about this whole these Olympic shenanigans. This is, you know, the point of the China trip was to appeal to you know, a new market, one that's been blossoming in a lot of ways. I know Sheng Peng, who used to write for our humble site and was in China for these games. Did write a piece before this game was even announced about the NHL's potential inroads in China and how it could benefit the Kings. Sarah, sort of a final thought on that front. What do you think the impact of making this kind of trip was?
Yeah, I think that, you know, just seeing all the stuff, especially that Sheng shared with, you know, the world on Twitter about, you know, they're going out in the community and working with kids and, you know, the NHL realizing that if they do want to grow the game internationally, they have to back it up with money and not just showing up and playing a couple games and going away. You know, I think that they've learned from their mistakes in past attempts to try to do something similar. I know Sheng wrote about, you know, went into Japan in the 90s, I believe, but then just sort of disappeared and didn't follow it up. But I feel like the bigger Olympic elephant in the room is how much has the NHL, you know, basically screwed themselves over with the IOC by saying, we're not going to go to Korea, but we really want to go to China where all the money is. The IOC could very easily change the rules or something to prevent the NHL from coming back into China. So, you know, they're trying to do all this work, but they're also kind of wanting to get to play both, you know, both sides of the coin here. It was really cool to get to see them have that experience, but I'll be interested to see, you know, what happens 4-ish years from now, if we're still going to be watching a team of college kids play the KHL.
Yeah, and James, I know you had some thoughts on this as well, so anything to add on that front?
Yeah, I've been meaning to write an article on how the NHL, you know, and I'm biased. I am Korean for the record, so I am disappointed to see the NHL skipping Korea and making it a priority to attend China. I understand, you know, they're doing the same thing the NBA is doing. They want to grow the game, and what better to grow the game than to go to a country of 1.3 billion? I understand that, but Korea is also a winter country and a rapidly growing economic country as well that's open to new ideas. And it also has a skating tradition. Korea has been to the Winter Olympics many times, and pretty much all of its Winter Olympic medals have been in skating. So the culture of skating is there in Korea. The culture of winter is there. The economics are there. Koreans have been in the NHL, Kings alum, Jim Pack, a stay-at-home defenseman, and also Richard Park, who's going to coach the Korean team. Mm-hmm. He's the only Korean to be engraved on the cup with the Penguins. So, you know, so Koreans do have a history with hockey, and, you know, it is upsetting to see the NHL skip a potential market for another one. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and it's because you do have an article to write, but you've got plenty of time before February of 2018. And I guess I did recently just see that the NBC is essentially blacking out the NHL for those 3 weeks as sort of a you know, take this for leaving yourselves out of our big money making enterprise. Robin, do you have any thoughts on this whole Olympic situation on behalf of either the Kings or your own personal opinion?
Okay, so actually I had a really interesting discussion over the summer, or I guess maybe several months ago, when the NHL announced that they were formally stopping any talks and whatnot. Somebody compared it to FIFA's World Cup, and they said that that's what the NHL is trying to do, and they just need time. And I'm still on the Olympic bandwagon personally, because it doesn't matter to those players how many times they go to FIFA's World Cup. They still want to represent their country for the Olympics. And so it doesn't matter what the NHL does. I just think it's funny that NBC has decided that they're going to essentially black out all these NHL games. And that is a huge revenue stream for the NHL that they're missing out on. And in terms of a big FU, I'm like, hey, you guys brought this on yourself.
Yeah. And it's an interesting thought, because I think you're right. I think there is an effort to make hockey's World Cup sort of stand up on that level. And, you know, I think there are fundamental differences between hockey, where you have one league that is sort of head and shoulders above the others, as opposed to soccer, where you've got leagues in England and Spain and France and Germany that are sort of all really on a global scale, have fans across the world, feature players from, you know, numerous countries. In each of these countries, you know, you don't just have, you know, the best Russian players by struggling between the KHL and the NHL, while you have the best American and Canadian players sticking to one league. In soccer, you have that global presence already. And the World Cup, you know, you have it once every 4 years. I guess that makes a difference too. But yeah, it's sort of a mystifying you know, situation. And I think I feel really bad for someone like Andrzej Kopitar, who qualified for the Olympics with Slovenia and is now not going to be able to play. And I don't think playing for Europe has sort of the same appeal as playing for Slovenia specifically does.
I'm sure we'll revisit it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
This Olympics in South Korea, I'm not going to say the name because I'm sure I'm going to butcher it. But this Olympics is supposed to be like the techiest Olympics ever. Hockey is a sport that thrives on technology. So I don't really understand why the NHL would, you know, essentially go back 100 years in time and say, no, we can't have this. We can't have these breakthroughs in technology that make our players better, stronger, faster, increase recovery time, make the game safer for players, bring the game to the audience, you know, essentially your paying customers, bring it to them in a new light. I mean, the whole box track thing was a big, horrible experiment in the 90s, but...
Yeah, that was something.
It's nostalgic to me, at least, because it was something that they were trying with the technology that was available at the time. So I'm like, this is a big opportunity for you to meet with some of the world's biggest tech manufacturers, and you're saying no thing? But, you know, that's the NHL.
Yeah, and if I may, the NHL is losing out. It's going to have to wait 4 more years to showcase itself to the rest of the world, and by not allowing its players to participate, viewers from all over the world, you know, are going to miss out on some of the most compelling hockey action there is, which is Olympic hockey with NHL players in it. So it's a loss for the game. The players have a lot of them have said, "What's the number one rule change you want? Let us play in the Olympics." So you know, the game of hockey is not going to be better for this move.
All right. I think it's hard to argue with either of you on that front. I know I'm going to be pretty disappointed when February rolls around, but hopefully at that point we're in the middle of a Kings winning streak, which I know never happens in January and early February, but, you know, a guy can dream. So I guess we'll move quickly into sort of an outlook for the season before we finish with some good old prospect talk. Sarah, we are starting to see season previews roll out. There seems to be sort of a consensus that the Kings are going to be in that 4, 5, maybe 6 spot in the Pacific Division and a bit of a slugfest with other teams trying to sneak into the playoffs. What do you think the outlook is? Do you think that's a fair guess? Are you more bearish or bullish on the Kings this year?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty fair guess. I think that, you know, the division's going to, you know, Arizona thinks maybe they'll be a little better, but probably won't be that much better. We have Vegas, which is just probably going to be a disaster no matter what. But, you know, it's still going to be the California teams and now Edmonton, you know, fighting it out. I guess Calgary too. Vancouver just sort of exists and isn't really.
They sure do.
They'll probably beat us like 3 times because that's what happens. I can't say I disagree with any of the outlooks, but I do find that I'm actually looking forward to the season just to see what happens between the coaching change and, you know, letting, you know, Kempe and probably Brodzinski actually get a full year with the team. You know, I'm excited about it. Realistic in that, like, do I think we're going to win the Stanley Cup? You know, maybe not. But, you know, I think this is a kind of the team turning over a new leaf. And so it should be interesting to see how they respond to all the off-season changes and how well they are at tweaking things that go wrong during the system or during the season, or if they just kind of keep plugging away and doing the same thing that isn't working.
Yeah. I guess, James, any thoughts on that as well? Any responses to Sarah or just your general opinion on the Kings outlook?
Well, you know, like I said, small sample size so far. I am relieved to see that the Kings can still put the puck in the net this preseason. But you really need to look at your closest rivals. And, you know, last year was pretty much a copy of 2 years back. You know, we were on the outside looking in. Edmonton and Calgary were the ones that made it. Well, look what's going on with Edmonton and Calgary. I think Edmonton is finals material, honestly. I think there's a sense there that there was some unfinished business against Anaheim, that they should have had it. It could have been so much better for them. And you know me, I'm a big faithful believer in Nick Jesus, and I think they have a shot at the finals this year. So Edmonton's on the rise, Calgary's on the rise, Winnipeg is on the rise as well with Patrick Laine and some good potential is happening there. I know that there's a sense there that there's no they're not going to tolerate another lottery season. There's a sense there they must make the playoffs. So where does that leave the Kings? I just get the sense, you know, to quote a former president, we're painting with pastels but not bold colors here. So, and understandable, you know, because the option, the leeway is just not there. But when you look at how much your rivals are improving compared to you, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to make a bold prediction, you know, with the data that you're seeing.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
We do know that San Jose is on the decline with with Patrick Marleau leaving. That's a serious vote of no confidence on Patrick Marleau's part against the Sharks. And they're also an aging core as well. So if the Kings are going to leapfrog against somebody else, it's probably going to be the Sharks. The Ducks are always going to be solid in the regular season. As usual, they're always a dark horse candidate to go far. I think that's where we stand.
Right on. And I like that you used unfinished business for the Oilers, considering that that was the Ducks' motto, I think, going in to last season. It's a nice little bit of synergy there. As for the Sharks and the Ducks, I guess Robin, especially since you're also sort of in San Jose's neck of the woods, maybe not in Sharks territory, but close enough. What are your thoughts on the California rivals? Do you think the Kings are going to be lagging behind those two teams this year?
I still see the Ducks as being potentially fighting out probably, I'm going to say Edmonton, probably for the division title. But I do feel that San Jose and LA are rather closely aligned, but I would still put, in terms of talent, from what I can tell so far, I'd still put San Jose a touch above LA, just because we don't really know what we're going to get out of Brodzinski and Kempe. And, you know, referring back to what Tara said earlier, you look at the bottom six and you go, ooh, you throw up your hands, basically. Who's going to score there? I don't know. The bottom six is where offense goes to die with the Kings. So if they can improve their bottom six, then I think that they'll have a better shot at being more than just a wild card team. But that bottom six needs major overhauls.
Yeah, and I think that puts up our throwing up our hands at the bottom six count at three for the Jewel cast today. So I'm sensing a theme here. I wonder myself. I'm always sort of optimistic about the Kings' chances. I know every analytic model is optimistic about the Kings because they always are, and every eye test or every general media seems to be pessimistic because of what happened last season. I struggle with Calgary just because I never think they're going to be as good as they are, or at least I don't know if they're going to find the production beyond, you know, their top line players, their Gaudreau or their Monahan. And I think that there's an opportunity to at least jump ahead of the Flames. And if you can do that, your playoff chances are looking pretty solid. But it's going to be a bit of a mess, I think, especially with the Central Division always being fairly strong too. So we'll be coming back. Go ahead, Robin. Sorry.
I was going to say Calgary. The other thing to keep in mind is that they keep being undone by terrible goalies, and they still really only have like 3/4 of a goalie because they have Mike Smith who will beat the Kings every time because that's just how it is. But then we'll like let in 6 goals against Vancouver probably. And Eddie Lack, who I love as a human, but his game has just been completely, like, messed up by every single team that he's been sent to. So Calgary can – Johnny Gaudreau can score a hat trick every night, but if the goalie behind him can't stop a puck, maybe we're not going to have to worry about Calgary. Like, I'm certain, but that could be the thing that keeps them, you know, also on the same sort of wild card out of the playoff bubble if their goaltending duo, quote unquote, doesn't actually come through for them.
I legit
Yeah, it's hard to keep track of that guy. And we'll see. I mean, I know that Jules is a very pro Eddie Lack blog, but it's, you know, it's a question of whether he's going to be able to find his form in Calgary, where LA might have been a better reclamation destination for him. Before we move on, I guess we didn't talk about the goaltending for the Kings, and there's not much to talk about in terms of starter. But do we believe that Darcy Kemper is going to be the right backup for this team? Are we more pro Jack Campbell? Cal Peterson has looked very good this preseason, but I don't think there's any rush to throw him into the fire. So I guess anyone, and this is dangerous because all three of you might start talking at once, but how do we feel about Darcy Kemper?
I guess I'll start. I've watched him off and on with Minnesota, and kind of like Eddie Lack, where, you know, when he's on, like, you know, obviously he looks like a business quality bully, and I guess you could really say that about pretty much any goalie, but I feel like he's
sure.
pretty streaky. You remember when we, obviously, because the four of us had absolutely nothing to do with that game in November, but when the Kings scored... Sorry, Sierra, I forgot that you were out on the ice scoring four goals, your meat trick.
Clearly.
Okay, Joe.
Doing it.
So, yeah, I mean, when the Kings scored four goals in the first period and they ended up chasing Kemper, I mean, he had a lot of those same struggles in Minnesota. I feel like the Kings, knowing them, they'll probably start with Zatkoff, since he's technically still on the roster. And then if he says they'll go to Darcy Kemper and they'll play, what is it, roulette or whatever. What did you say, Sarah, with the defenseman?
I have no idea what I said, but roulette is a really good word.
Shuffle. Shuffle. You said shuffle.
Right.
It was a game.
I think that's a fair assumption. James, you have any thoughts on the goalies?
Well, actually, starting goalie is an issue, actually. I know we love Quick, and I'm glad that China has got an opportunity to see what we see every game, and we're just so privileged and spoiled to see greatness and high level of compete every time from Quick. But people are overlooking that Jonathan Quick is now starting to become an injury risk. He is 31. He has a highly athletic style, which is not going to serve him very well in the coming years, because a highly athletic style is bound to get him injured. He's already missed many games last season, and, you know, who knows what might happen. Hopefully he'll stay healthy like Jeff Carter, but if he doesn't, he'll turn out to be the next Marian Gaborik as far as goalies are concerned. So it's going to be imperative for the Kings. Any backup is going to have to provide at least 20 games. Quick can't keep shouldering, you know, 90-95% of the workload anymore, and neither should he. I mean, we have backup for a reason. So Kemper, you know, he's done well against the Kings. I believe he's the one that's known for doing really well against, of course, so has everybody else, but
sure.
Kemper is good enough. Zatkoff, I'm sorry, you're a good guy, but you're not NHL material. And if Kemper's not available, I'm sure we can inspire the third option to give it his all for one or two games. So I think we're all right. It's just that the backups, it's imperative to take a much bigger role now.
Well, you're following in a proud Jewels from the Crown tradition on your first Jewel cast of questioning Jonathan Quick. And we've caught a lot of flack in the past for being a very anti-Jonathan Quick blog, where I would argue that is not the case. But that's a moot point at this point, because we know Quick is going to start and going to play until his legs fall off, or I guess his groin falls off, which is not a pleasant image. Before we talk about that, I guess then one final follow-up question for Sarah. Do you think that the Kings needed to find a better backup? Do you think that they need to go they couldn't keep Ben Bishop, but look for sort of a 1B instead of a clear backup?
I would have been fascinated to see them try a 1B kind of thing, especially, like James said, Jonathan Quick is prone to falling apart physically at some times. And I wonder if it's a little bit of a kind of pride thing, because you could probably argue the same thing with like the Rangers and Henrik Lundqvist. He's getting older, he's had a history of injuries, maybe they should move to getting someone else who can play more of the season. But, I think that Jonathan Quick is probably the same way, where he wants to play every single game possible. And do you argue with him? Like, do you say, guess what, we're doing a platoon this year, and, risk having the sort of same awkward situation they had in, Pittsburgh with Murray and Marc-Andre Fleury, who, was at least very gracious about the whole situation. But I think it's something the Kings really need to start preparing for. When I was writing about Cal Peterson for the part of our top prospects list, I just took a quick look at, what Jonathan Quick's contract looks like, and I gasped because I forgot that he signed until, eternity, like literally cap-friendly. Yeah. If you go all the way to the right, it's Andre Kopitar, Jonathan Quick, and paying Mike Richards. Like, that's it for the next, 100 years. So he's here forever. And I'm trying to imagine a scenario where he takes a lesser role or has a 1B kind of situation, or the Kings eventually have to trade him. And I'm imagining, the blog melting down at anyone who writes about that. And someone's probably going to be really angry at me for even, thinking it. But I think it's got to be a thought in the back of everyone's minds. I mean, I see Jonathan Quick make one of those crazy, angry cat split saves, and I just, cover my eyes, waiting to see if he's going to get back up. So it's inevitable that we're going to have to find a better backup. I've seen a lot of Darcy Kuemper being someone who has to watch a lot of Central Division games living out here, and I've not always been impressed, but, we have goaltending coach magic out here, so out in L.A., so maybe he'll become the amazing backup goalie that we don't know that he will be.
No, can't rule it out. What was that, Robin?
Oh, I said no more Mr. Game 1. I don't know why, but there was something when won the cup in 2016, they all bets off Mr. Game 1.
Yeah, he came through as our as the good old Pittsburgh third stringer, I think, against the Rangers, which,
yep.
Obviously he wasn't able to back up this year. But. So I think then let's go ahead and just end with we've got, a maximum of 15 minutes left. So we'll go ahead and go with the prospects real quick, just because we have been doing the top 25 under 25 for almost exactly a month at this point. And we've made it all the way to number 5, who is, of course, Mike Amadio, who we talked about a little bit earlier on the podcast. But we're going to be going back through the 20 on Twitter this week and maybe promoting some of those on Facebook as well. And I just want to get your guys' opinions on a couple of things. First of all, I know Sarah's answer to this question already because she submitted a ballot for the top 25 under 25 as one of our staff voters. But we do have 4 players left, and I'm going to spoil them because it's obvious, but I'm not going to spoil the order. In alphabetical order, the top 4 are going to be alphabetical order by last name, Johnny Brodzinski, Cale Klaig, Adrian Kempe, and Gabe Vilardi, who have come from wildly different backgrounds and positions and talents to be our top four. So I guess I'll start with you, James. Who do you think should be the number one player on the top 25 under 25?
Well, it's the safe choice, but between Kempe and Brodzinski, it's definitely Kempe. I'm reminded of the Kevin Gravel's first NHL goal, which Kempe did a Kempe's a very intelligent thread-the-needle pass to a wide-open Kevin Gravel under poise and the intelligence and required to think of something like that when he too was in front of the net and he could have easily just shot it, but if he did, he would have just probably just shot it back at the goalie. So to think of that extra play to make and to dish it off to a wide open Kevin Gravel, I thought showed a lot of intelligence on his part. So I know Kempe is the safe choice, but that's what I'm going to go with. Now, I'd like to, while we're on this, you guys understand Nick Schorr is 24. I wonder where Nick Schorr falls on this top 25 under 25 list.
He turns 25 tomorrow, so he has been ruled out due to being 25 on opening night. I do wonder where he would have fallen to, though, because I think last year, I think I have that list here, and he came in at number four. Between Gravel at number five and Kempe at number three, the top two, of course, being Pearson and Toffoli. A lot of people aged out this year. And Nick Schorr, he sort of falls, I think, in where, we didn't really have a player like this year, but in past seasons, when we've gotten to players like, you know, when we voted on Jordan Nolan or Andy Andrioff or Kyle Clifford being in the top 25, they were never really particularly close to the top because everybody was sort of saying, well, we know who they are. We're not, you know, we're just really excited about this other young guy who maybe is more unproven but could be the savior of the franchise. I think that if Kempe turns out to be number one, I think it's because he has shown more at the NHL level than any other player on the list, maybe by far at this point. Robin, do you have a number one choice out of Brodzinski, Klaig, Kempe, and Vilardi?
I mean, Kempe and Brodzinski are basically 1-2 in my book. I think I would probably give the edge to Kempe because when he was drafted, I started following his career in Sweden when I was writing about the prospects for Keeping Up with the Kids, which I had to suspend, unfortunately. Just no time.
Sure.
Anyway, so he got about 15, he was getting about 12 to 13 minutes on average. And then the next season, after he got drafted, he started getting around 14 to 15 minutes, but he wasn't really doing that well. Except it was kind of interesting because when he came to America to start his pro career, he improved drastically. I mean, he was a massive part of the Monarchs' Calder Cup run. And even between switching between wing and center, something he hadn't done since he was in juniors, like he actually showed a pretty decent amount of poise and he's improved. The offense, I still think, could be. Like, goal-scoring-wise, I think Brodzinski is probably a better pure goal scorer, but as an all-around player, I'd probably give the edge to Kempe.
Okay. Sarah, I'm not going to let you answer the same question because it might be a top 25 spoiler because your vote counts. So, instead, I just want to ask about the other two guys because we have talked about Kempe and we have talked about Brodzinski. First of all, Gabe Vilardi, do you think that, I've seen, I think, Corey Pronman of ESPN, now The Athletic, because everybody writes for The Athletic now, was writing his prospect roundup and ranking the teams by farm system, and he moved the Kings up to, from basically the bottom five to right smack in the middle just because they picked Vilardi and because they made, you know, maybe a couple other good choices in the draft. Do you think Vilardi's ceiling is above any other King prospect right now? And if so, where do you think that ceiling is?
Yeah, I think he does have a pretty high ceiling. I don't know that I, just because, you know, there's so much you can have. You can have a guy who's great in juniors and then turns out to be a bust in, you know, the pros. I don't know that I would put him above every other prospect, but and especially given the fact that we didn't really get to see him in any preseason or prospect camp kind of stuff because of the injury that he's dealing with. But I do think that he's, you know, a pretty highly regarded player, good, like, all around. You know, eventually we're going, you know, Anze Kopitar and Jeff Carter are not going to be here forever. We're going to need, you know, more top centers, and he's someone who could fill that role. I'm excited to get to see what he does again in juniors this year. I actually live within driving distance of Windsor, and I'm hoping to maybe get to take a little Windsor Spitfire OHL trip if they don't, like, trade him to some other team that I can't get to hopefully actually get to see him skate. But I think that it'll be interesting to see, you know, what he does in, you know, the rest of his junior's career and how he can transition to that, to the pros as well.
Yeah, and that center pipeline certainly is strong at this point. Even if, you know, even if Vilardi isn't a world beater at the NHL level, he's you know, a really strong prospect who could be, you know, could be in the NHL in 2 years if things go well for him. And lower down on the top 25, we had Amadio today. We had Jared Anderson Dolan, who I know, Sarah, you and I talked about a lot on the last JewelCast, who was right behind at number six. So there's definitely options down the middle. And, you know, the defense is a little more of a question mark, which is why I'm excited about Gale Kuig, and I was excited that we got to see a little bit of him during the Anaheim game. He didn't, you know, I didn't get to watch him quite as much as some of the other guys. I think that Stuthers was very conservative with putting the 18 and 19 year olds out there too much, but Kuig made a couple good defensive plays. He stopped a goal almost on the goal line against Anaheim, but he got blown by Scott Sabourin, who is a Rain player and an AHLer, and it's, you know, it's going to be an adjustment for him. Mm-hmm. But he made a big jump last year. He played for Canada at the World Juniors, and I'm excited to see what he's capable of. And we'll have something on him this week. Sarah, I think you're writing about him. And
sure.
Then, of course, Brodzinski and Vilardi and Kempe as well. So that's this is where I put in the plug that our first 21 entries in the series, individual entries this year, are all on the site. If you've missed them, then please come check them out. I know I've had a really good time writing the ones that I do. It's been, you know, it was really interesting getting to learn about, you know, like Chaz Redkop and Jacob Moverar and other players who I knew very little about going into the season. So keep up with us on that front. We've still got four more days of that, and then we go full bore into season preview content and, of course, the season, which starts on October 5th, I believe. So let's go ahead and wind down then before we get cut off by the Blog Talk Radio robot. So one final question, just a rapid fire go around. James, do the Kings make the playoffs this year?
I'm a fan, so yes.
All right, Robin.
I'm gonna have to go with yes. I mean, we gotta hope for the best, right?
I like the attitude, Sarah.
I almost want to be a jerk and say no, but I also feel I think they make the playoffs as a wild card.
Same.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'll join you guys on that train. I will go with third place in the Pacific just to be original and or overly optimistic about John Stephens' difference-making abilities. But yeah, I just don't see them, you know, repeating all of the things that went wrong last year. So, you know, it's good to know that we're in a good mindset, but as we put some stuff up on the site in the next few days, maybe we'll be able to defend our optimism, our muted optimism as it is. So we'll go ahead and stop there. Again, thanks for listening. If you're a first-time listener, you've just gotten to know Jules from the ground, stick around. I know in addition to the top 25 articles on the site, we do have a few articles about the preseason. We have some features on some of the lesser-known players, Oscar Fantenberg, which just went up, some of the professional tryout players such as Chris Lee and Brooks Like, who we didn't talk about at all, probably because their chances aren't looking too good of making the team at this point. But we'll have a lot more on the Kings themselves, on some of the NHL-level players, and on some of the positional battles. But for now, I think that'll be it. So thanks, everyone, for listening. James, Robin, Sarah, thanks again for coming on the JewelCast.
Thank you. Pleased to be here. Have a good night.
All right. Thanks. And everyone out there, have a good night, too. Bye.